This is John Costa on Spotlight on Heritage with Rob Watson. And this week we're in the basement gallery, just having a bit of a reflection on last Saturday's Saturday Heritage Fair and the Dock Space exhibition, which is finishing this Friday down here in the basement gallery at Leicester Adult Education Centre. And we're going to talk a little bit about the future as well. So, Rob, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, John. How are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you. So, you did you enjoy the event? That's the main thing.
Oh, I'm exhausted. I mean, still. I mean, I don't know how you are, because it was just a really busy day with a lot of buzz and a lot of people interested in heritage, which was great. But in that informal sense, there was no airs and graces. It was just go and chat to people and enjoy yourself.
Well, I think that's the thing that works so well about it, actually, is the informality, but also it's not about what's behind a glass cabinet. It's more about what have I got in my bag, or what have I got on my in this cardboard box, or you know, this item that I've carried here that I've inherited from somewhere. How do I find out about what it is and what it's for, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that was good. I brought a few things. It was like a couple of radios,
but it sparks conversation, doesn't it, Alan?
Yeah and it was just nice to spend the day chatting, finding out more in a bit more detail. So we had community reporters. These have been played out, if you've heard them on Source Sound already. They were played out last week, and some went out on the day, and it was just nice to have people go wandering about, doing, you know, finding people interesting. And Roger and Harkesh did a great job of chatting to people, so you can kind of find out a bit more, and people being able to offer and, you know, exchange and share their thoughts and ideas and motivate. Really, what's more interesting is not what they do, but why they do it. And when you start to get those kind of people open up about that, and you know, they're not just giving you the functional information. You know, we're based here and we do this. It's like when you're talking to people and they say, "Well, this is why I do it, because I'm excited about this." That's what's always really nice that comes through from that. And if that happens spontaneously, which I think it did on the day, then I'm really happy.
Yeah, well, that's it's the deeper meaning, isn't it? You know, what tends to happen with the mainstream media, or maybe social media to an extent, is like, you know, this is what's going on, and this is what they do, and this is how I do it, and this is the people that, you know, we're representing and what it's for. Whereas actually this deeper conversation that comes from community reporters like, you know, Harkesh, or when Helen does it, and with Roger, is you start getting behind the headlines, behind the facts, behind the dates, and start thinking about people and why people do certain things.
Yeah, and you know, it's always great talking to Sue Lester. We've interviewed her a few times, because that's what she always describes, doesn't she? You know, it's that it's the things that you didn't think you'd find out, and the little things that you wondered were at face value inconsequential, or, you know, kind of tangential. And then actually, no, that's what gives you the pivot point, or the route into a broader understanding of that's why somebody was associated with this. You know, oh, they lived in this house and it's related to this area and they worked at this place. So you've got those interconnections. And I think that in a way, the kind of the whole event for me, and you as the organizer of this, you know, kind of, maybe you don't do this consciously, but it is about interconnections, and it's a brokerage of stories, which is that mutual exchange of stories, and everybody's there to tell a story rather than just thinking that they're there to tick boxes. They wanted to be there to tell stories. And there goes my phone. I should have turned that off, shouldn't I?
I think what also freaks people out a little bit is when I tell them about the level of detail that goes into where people are placed and what stores they're on and who their neighbours are and why they're in a particular section, and also that there's a flow to the event that is created as well. So you're meant to not go around it in a particular direction, but there's a certain flow to it as well. So you'll never find someone will be randomly plopped in the middle of nowhere without there being a reason why they're connected with next door. So I do try and put a lot of time and effort into that kind of a level of detail. So Rob, when you go to events like the one Saturday, I know it's totally unique, but if you were to go to another event like that, are you conscious of placement of stalls and where people are, and you know, why are the Vikings there next to World War One? You know, how does that work? Does that really bother you?
It doesn't. Well, to the extent that you'd like to be able to circulate, so there's got to be plenty. And the thing that you did was you provided plenty of space in between, because there's nothing worse than, you know, 20 people all crammed against one stall because it's got something, and then the rest, nobody circulates around. So you've got to encourage that flow of people. But then at the same time, there's a space at the side where you can stand off and have a conversation. So if somebody wants to come, so the worst thing is when you're, you know, a stall holder is talking to people over the table, because then if somebody comes along and wants to browse and look and is just listening, so you need a space at the side where the person is encouraged to stand at the side of the table, so the table remains free. It's those little things, and you provided that space in between each of the stalls, so you didn't have a group hogging the table. So if somebody walks past, all you're seeing is people's backs. What you're actually seeing is the displays, and encouraging the stall holders. It's that level of interaction. Don't talk to yourselves. You're not there to have conversations with yourselves. You're there to engage with people and reach out and talk to the visitors, or talk to the other stall holders, you know, the other network of people that have come. So for me, that's a kind of, you know, it's often the first practical thing that you think of. And then, am I interested in what they're doing? And yeah, loads of them are genuinely interested, and you can get a good conversation out of people, which we did.
So. Yeah, and things like dwell time as well. You know, who's got display boards to read and who's got items for you to look at that are like flat lay, and then those that are, you know, going to be drawn because they're providing information that people can come and ask for. And then there's other people where it's more about the kind of the interaction and the conversation. People, oh, this is interesting, what's this? I don't know anything about this. So I try to think about where I place people, so there's always something. I think there's nothing worse is that when you go into something like an art and craft fair, slightly different, you know, where people are selling products, and then people kind of walk around and try not to catch the eye of the person sitting behind the stall, have a look at the products and then disappear. Whereas for me, because there isn't anything for sale per se, apart from the odd book, you know, Ned knew it was great. He came this and supported this time with a bookstore. And I know the family history guys have some books that are for sale, secondhand books. But apart from that, it's every stallholder wants you to stop because they're genuinely interested in your thought processes and what you're going to say and what you're doing, or your personal anecdote or story about that particular subject. And they get something out of that, I think. So actually it's quite transactional. It's not just they're there to give you information or for you to take information from them. They're actually wanting you to ask questions. They're actually looking for you to have a personal story to share.
And there's something we did a Jubilee Square event with the City Council a few weeks ago, and one of the feedback that we were talking about was they really, you know, they like the podcasts and stuff that we did. And what we talked about is if your visitors come and they're not familiar with you and they don't feel that you're an approachable person, so it's like, you know, they don't know you, or they don't know the stall holders, well, we've not done our job properly. You've got to communicate with people in advance so that when they come in, they go, oh, I know this Sue Lester, I've heard it. Oh, she's a really nice person. Or this guy who runs this thing, I want to find out about these memorials. I want to find out about this project. But you know the person in advance. And that's why I think the audio and the podcasting is really good, because it's a more friendly way of doing things rather than really just communicating at people. So you're building up a sense of trust and familiarity, is that you're an approachable person. You're not just somebody who's kind of, you know, from the university. You're there as somebody who is on an equal level with you as a visitor.
Yeah.
Even if you're starting from that base point of going, well, I don't know anything about this, it's very welcoming environment for people to go, yeah, come in and have a chat with it, listen to a conversation, watch what people are doing. There's some talks. You can easily become familiar and relaxed and comfortable with this.
And I think also the thing people find quite interesting but don't necessarily realize when they walk in is they think, oh, it's a heritage event, and we can talk a lot about that, but history and all those sort of things, but all of it is contemporary. You know, even the Vikings, it's contemporary, you know, coming over on boats. You know, the Afghan Language and Research Cafe, you know, talking about health of people that are coming, fleeing conflict, that kind of stuff. You know, quite, you know, they're here, they've not come illegally, they've claimed asylum. But then, you know, Kadir, who's a journalist in his own right from Afghanistan, has then made a 7-minute documentary in a hotel in Manchester. The chances are that very hotel was protested a couple of weeks ago when we had those kind of, you know, protests in across the UK. So everything that you do, it doesn't matter what it is, the at-risk war memorials guys just doing plain old war memorials, all of it has a contemporary angle. If the person behind the stall is willing to engage in that kind of conversation, and if the person that comes in says, can you help me make some sense of this so that I can actually have a conversation with you, not just about an item that I've got, but about the relevance. Now, the thing I always say to people is the reason you can still talk about World War One and World War Two, not because you're interested in the Battle of Britain or trench fighting or, you know, D-Day or any of these things, yeah, but actually, as a nation, we were at war. Not just the people in combat, the people at home, the people left behind, the people doing the war work in factories. It changed how women were treated. You know, the vote after World War One, then World War Two. So all of these things, they're still shaped. A lot of our laws and customs and things that we take for normal or our social norms are all shaped in conflict. Even the clocks going forward in a couple of weeks' time. You know, that was all based on wartime changing of growing times for farmers with sunlight. You know, so we don't understand that. We don't learn that in school. We learn about Henry VIII and his wives. We learn about the Mary Rose. We don't learn anything relevant to living and engaging in society today.
I think the clocks go back, spring forward and fall back. Just to get it right in my own head. Sorry. And then I think there's two things that come from this. It's the idea that this is, we're underinvested in society in sense-making institutions and processes. So that ability for people to come in and make sense of something. And it didn't, these things, when you take a historical perspective, it's easy to kind of think that these things logically and sequentially happened. X plus Y led you to Z. It doesn't work like that. When you're at X, you don't know if you're going to get Y, or if you're going to get P or T or what, you know, B, whatever it is, and you don't know what the calculation is to turn it into something after that. And we were stuck in a way of thinking, which is that it was inevitable that we ended up with the conflict of the First World War because of these factors. And it's like, it wasn't inevitable. Nothing is ever inevitable. It's how it's dealt with at the time and whose interests are being served and all those. So it was a living picture. And having the testimony of different groups of people, from ordinary people, ordinary squad, Tommies, ordinary people back in the home front, people in, you know, the kind of the medical profession, all those kind of things, that brings it forward as something which is more nuanced, more complex, and it's relatable to our lives today, because we don't know what's happening tomorrow. We know what some of the factors are that are going to influence it, but we don't know how this is going to play out, and we trust that some of our leaders have got a sense of where this is going and how it will play out. And we hope we're in good hands, but at the same time, might not be.
So this is John Costa with Rob Watson, and we're doing a spotlight on heritage. We've just been reflecting back on the Saturday Heritage Fair. Rob, now, next week we've got some training in the evening that you've organised and coordinated with Sam Hunt, who's one of the directors of Saw Sound Radio, on which we put the spotlight on heritage and spotlight on art. And you're doing something where you've invited some organisations to come and find out about doing their own spotlight show for different sectors and stuff like that. What kind of approach are you looking to get with people? Because again, I should imagine, looking at the guys that came and volunteered on Saturday, Roger and Harkesh went round. Knowing Harkesh the way that I do, he's not coming at it from a reporter's perspective. He's coming at it from, or a news perspective. He's coming at it from you've got a story to tell, and I'm interested in you telling that story. The difference is, when we talk to these organisations next week about having a spotlight, how do we deal with that balance between they're seeing it as a way of an audio version of a brochure, as opposed to what you and I record as spotlight shows?
Yeah, I mean, as the word reporter is obviously wrapped up with a lot of different things, and I usually tend to draw a distinction between journalist and reporter. So I view, in my kind of head, whether this is true or not, and I'm happy for other people to contradict
Invite
me,
us into your head, Rob.
You don't want to go there. Is a journalist is somebody who's got a purpose to investigate and reveal something. A reporter just tells you what's happening. So there's, you know,
almost like a commentary kind of, yeah, like if you're not there or if you're listening.
You want a journalist to uncover the hidden things. You want them to push past the wall of PR and presentation and
spin.
And spin and the illusion that's created about people's reputations and people's activities and all that kind of stuff. And the journalist gets over through that barrier and says, no, this is what they're actually up to. This is what this person's done. And they look for the systems and they look for the links and the correspondences within that. A reporter, and particularly a community reporter, is somebody who just kind of says, this is what's happening today in our neighbourhood. These are the people, and this is what they're doing. So you're taking things at a little bit more of a face value. You still have to be critical, but you're not pushing. You're not pushing into looking in somebody's dustbins to find out where their bank statements are, that kind of thing. What you're doing is you're saying to them, come and have a chat and tell us who you are, and you're creating that trusted network. So you're building up a group of people who are prepared. And the challenge at the moment, I think, is there really is a hesitancy for people to talk openly and discuss things, because the BBC locally in Leicester, for example, less than 40% of their output is originated from Leicester for Leicester now. Most of it's regionalised, so the East Midlands and national. So that means there's a gap there for people to tell their stories and share their experiences. So having that element, a space for a trusted reporter to feed that back to readers and listeners, and we work with the Evington Echo, Arkesh is a community reporter for the Evington Echo, is to say it's okay, maybe it's more of a feature, maybe it's more of it fills in the colours of the picture, but it isn't driven by investigation. If we need to investigate something, we'll find a local journalist that we'll pass that on to. So anybody can be a community reporter, and Elon Musk uses this phrase, hate him or love him, whatever your opinions are about him, we are the media, which is like, well, it's a tagline that we've used for a long time, and it's about giving people the confidence that there's a trust, there's a third way of doing this, is that we come together as a community ourselves and we say and report on things which we know we're being we're doing appropriately, and that we're not flying off on tangent or great big ideological crusades, but it's very much about, well, what's life like in my neighbourhood? What's life like amongst my circle of friends and peers and the church or temple I go to? What's going on with those people? Because actually, that's where we need to rebuild trust.
Yeah, I guess that commonality, isn't it? The things that are impacting all of our communities, no matter what the divisions are, socioeconomic or whether it's religious or nationality or gender, whatever. At the end of the day, needing to find a job is as impactful on someone from any particular community as it is for anywhere else, or being safe or being able to access health services and stuff like that. So I think these things are really important that we need to...
We're on the same level, and we've got to start having some confidence, and we've got to start drawing in the competent people, colleagues. And I put this out to people that, I'd say this unashamedly, is that if you're relatively competent, whatever that means, you're relatively competent, then you have a responsibility to get involved with your local community media organisation, whatever form that takes. Don't just leave it for somebody else to solve these problems. Roll your sleeves up, learn how to do it. It's not difficult. Stations, I'm not just saying Source Sound, we've got 9 other community radio stations in Leicester that you can take part in. And we had Satsang Radio were with us at the Heritage Fair. We work with Utsav, we work with Kohinoor, we work with Too Funky, we work with Eva FM, all of the stations that are there. There's a good mix, and there's no reason for you not getting involved, to be that, that point of contact for people to go, this is about people like me and my community, but also to work across those communities as well. So you're not just talking to an echo chamber, but you're bridging across communities as well. And I think that's the great thing about the Heritage Fair. It was a bridging day of contacts that you could make from lots of different types of people that wouldn't normally come together without that element of kind of the links that you've fostered and you've networked and brought people together with.
Now, recently you went out with one of the volunteers who was interested in finding out more about how to do vox pops and stuff on the street. And when you came across a member of the public, it was perfectly fine. What do you think of this? They give you their opinion. You can ask a deeper question. Someone will give you a bit more of an answer, hopefully, or not want to engage. And then you spoke to someone who was employed by the local authority, and they instantly were like, oh, I don't know what to say. I need to go and ask permission. Now, rightly or wrongly, that was their right to say that. But the people we're inviting next week for the conversation or the training about finding out about Spotlight, a lot of these people will be decision makers, as opposed to people that need to go off and get a decision. So the decision makers there, it's convincing them, isn't it, that actually the mainstream media that they've used before are no longer interested in them, and therefore it's realizing that something like community radio or community media, which was always there, is actually going to be the answer now, because the mainstream media's pulled back from all of this engagement at that lower level because they're just not interested.
Yeah, and it, you know, you would say media travels at the speed of trust, and if nobody trusts your media, then you don't get any engagement. And there's a general distrust about media these days. We don't trust the institutions in the way that we used to, and the institutions, plausibly arguable that they're not, you know, there's a lot of failure with our media institutions because they're not modernising, they're not keeping up, and they're not serving citizens.
And they don't seem to be particularly bothered, are they?
Well, it's become the danger is that it's a claim that can stick if you throw the mud at them, which is that they're running themselves for themselves, and they're not actually running them for the people.
The audience.
The citizens. I mean, an audience. Yeah. You can create an audience. I mean, for example, you know.
So it is an audience, well, but that audience is no longer.
Well, both the BBC and a newspaper like The Guardian and The Daily Mail, they're aiming for an international audience. Mm. They're not actually serving the UK audience. So from Leicester, we've got very little Leicester, you know, very little content generated in Leicester. We got an apology out of BBC Radio Leicester. Through a freedom of information request and a complaint, because they'd run a trailer saying the only radio made in Leicester for Leicester. And it's like, hang on a minute, there are 9 other community radio stations here all making content from Leicester for Leicester. So they apologised for that and said it only went out for a short time, but they realised that they overreached. And it's like, you've got to check these things. And things have moved on. And I think the big differences now, there are alternative routes for this. The gatekeepers have no longer got control of this. You don't just have to go to the Leicester Mercury, BBC Leicester, ITV Central News to get your story out. You've got to engage across a whole range of social media platforms. I mean, they got Lee, who does the video.
Lee Spencer, yeah.
I mean, he's probably got more trust and engagement for the things that he does than your BBC Regional News in Leicester,
because there's an authenticity to what he does.
I mean, he does. You know, it's not high powered journalism or anything, but you find out more. Oh, you see what it is, and it's you know, he's authentic. Yeah, he's authentic.
It's a point of view thing, isn't it? So, Rob, in this last section, I know it's a really big ask sometimes, isn't it, to turn around and say to people, oh, you know, come up with the answer, or you know, what's the solution to this problem? But it seems to me that we need less big festivals in the city that draws people in from a touristic point of view, or people to come in and almost like fetishize the city from the county, as opposed to understanding some of the real deep-rooted issues and challenges that we have. You know, the Leicester Block Party, for example, the other night is an example of that. You know, for that community living around there, we've lost the ability to be able to talk about some of the challenges that we've got with society, whether rightly or wrongly multiculturalism has worked or it hasn't worked or any of these challenges. But what it does is, because we're not addressing it head on, we're always either ignoring it or we're talking around it, that what we're finding is that it's either left to the mainstream media to completely ignore it, yeah, or it's left to social media to stoke the fire and do that. Whereas, as you said, with the bridging event, it was, for me, the heritage fairs are very much around being able to bring communities together that wouldn't no longer be, it's very different from the Citizens Eye days, of being interested in each other's news and everybody went to Diwali and loved it, and everybody went to Caribbean Carnival and loved it. It's more about now that the commonality between food and, you know, drinking coffee, entertainment, how we do intergenerational learning between our children and our older people. When you start looking at those kind of things, that's where the commonality draws itself in, and one stallholder can look at another community and think, well, actually they're natural partners for us. I'd never have thought of that because I've taken the time to go and look at their display.
I think one of the things that's really, we're at a shift point, and I call it breaking the queue for the begging bowl. So much of our public civic infrastructure, our arts, culture, all the rest of it is funded through national, local, regional committees like the Arts Council, like the lottery, and basically you've got to tick a load of boxes, you've got to speak the right kind of talk, you've got to, you know, approach projects in a particular way. And actually what was great with the, and what we're trying to achieve with Source Sound, we're not averse to taking money off people. Government money or whatever.
Yeah, not get in touch.
but at the same time, you know, the independent funding is really crucial because, you know, having civic society that pays for itself, that circulates an economy. This is something called the foundational economy where, you know, you're not extracting the value. The money that is generated comes back into Leicester, goes back into the communities that it serves, rather than it being taken out by some consultancy firm from outside. You're not bringing people in from outside to do it. You're developing the skills and the capacity within your communities itself. And that independence allows you to do things in the way that you wish to do them and the group of people who are involved wish to do them. Like, the, you know, the exhibition that you've got here in the basement at the Adult Education Centre, you know, you organised this and you brought these people together and they participated in it. Now, it's got to be funded, but if you were looking over your shoulder having to fill in a project report for the Arts Council saying that you've met these objectives and done it this way, kills the joy. It's just, you know, everybody recognises that there's something's got to change about the way that we conceive and manage the funding process because it's become overly professionalised and it's overly, it's risk averse. It isn't widespread. It's very narrow and there's accusations of favouritism around certain communities over and above other communities because these committees are unaccountable. And you just get your rejection from the Arts Council or the lottery and you have to live, you know, you look at what it says and you go, well, maybe next time. But it's a thankless task and it takes a lot of effort to apply for these things. And what if we were funding this ourselves, between ourselves? And it was, you know, you didn't charge a fee for people to exhibit or attend.
Which is very important for me.
Yeah, but where does that come from? Because you can't be doing things for free. Where are you getting your income from? You're cross-subsidising from other things. Now, if there's a benefit for that, that needs to be recognised and acknowledged. We live in a world where we do have to start thinking about how we fund things ourselves and between ourselves. And local authorities and arts councils and all the rest of it, they can go off and do what they want to do, but we've got a sustainable middle self-funding part of this.
That kind of slightly independence. Okay, so just the last 30 seconds then. So we spoke a bit about authenticity as well. Do you think that authenticity with that independence gives the confidence for people to be able to do it?
I think this is what the area that we need to work on. I don't think people are ready for it yet, but they'll have to come around to it because there's going to be, you know, the money is not going to be allocated to these things in the future, and if we want them to carry on, we're going to have to find ways of doing it between ourselves and not waiting for the government funding to charge in on a white horse with a silver-clad knight to provide us with all this funding. It's not going to happen. We've got to do it. DIY, we've got to do it.
Rob, thanks very much. Always a pleasure, never a chore.
Well, I'm looking forward to when the next event is. So we've got to start planning for the Source Sound Christmas event at the Clock Tower, which I think is the 23rd of December. No, not the 23rd, 20th or something like that. Saturday before Christmas. So.
You'll be here soon enough.
Yeah.